Well, good morning. It's fun to start off with some energy. Thanks, band, for that. And for all of us singing along, that was a great way to start. Well, I'm just bringing up my little manuscript here, so we'll get there. During the first half of the 20th century, in the early 1900s, if that's kind of, you know, the whole century 19 thing, it's a bit confusing. The nation of Australia had a unique policy for working with their Aboriginal population. Their goal was to assimilate native populations into the greater mainstream society. They did so through a policy of forcibly relocating children, mostly mixed-race children, out of native families and into white families, thinking that eventually they could kind of wipe everybody clean and everybody could be essentially white. These children eventually became known as the Stolen Generation. In 1997, a report was released by the name of Bringing Them Home. It had been commissioned by the then Federal Attorney General in an effort to really understand what had happened in those decades. The report estimated that about 100,000 children had been relocated from their homes, and the effect was the kids grew up without any sense of understanding of their cultural heritage, that families were broken apart, and that whole communities just ceased to exist within a generation. And so began the effort of figuring out what could be done. How do you make this right? Now, lest the my Australian friends in the room think I'm unfairly picking on Australia, it's worth acknowledging that countries all over the world, ours, North America, Canada, USA, have all had issues dealing with our native populations, and it's a black mark against many of our societies. But in Australia, they tried to figure out, okay, what can be done? Given the magnitude of this violation, how do you fix it? How do you bring restitution to a situation like this? When something has gone so wrong, how can you possibly set it right? Well, today we're continuing our series in the life of David called The Life of Passion. We've been studying this for the last 10 months or so. We've gone through different chapters of David's life, and now we're in the chapter of his life that we've labeled Elder. That's the meaning of the faceless beard that you've been seeing on the slides. It's a little odd, but that's not a costume. It's the elder's beard. And as we go into this scene, we're beginning a series, a couple of chapters that most commentators think is not a strictly chronological connection to the rest of the story. So this is kind of like an epilogue to David's life in the last few chapters of 2 Samuel. We're looking back over some stories that probably took place in different time periods, and we're reflecting on who David was as a king. This morning we're looking at a situation that's not very different from what happened in Australia in the 20th century. Saul, the previous king, had mistreated a people group. His administration had violated the rights of some people living within Israel's territory. In essence, a covenant had been broken. And David was faced with the challenging task of figuring out how to make right something that had gone wrong. He was trying to figure out how to appease the victims, how to give mercy to the victims in a way that also honored God in the process. David has to learn about dispensing the king's justice. Now, you've noticed that we have International Justice Mission as a guest with us this morning. We're hosting an event, a regional event, this evening. IJM contacted me a few months ago and said, hey, we'd like to do this event on May 22nd. How does that look? And I looked up our David calendar, which had been published for months, and found this odd story that we're going to be looking at this morning about Gibeonites hanging a bunch of people. And I thought, well, that's a weird story. But as the more I looked into it, the more I realized that this story is, in fact, all about justice. And so this is one of those great things where God has just combined things in ways that we could not have controlled or predicted, and we get to kind of witness how God had set this morning up to be really all about us thinking about God's heart for justice. And it's important because one of the deepest values that we hold as people is that we deserve to be treated rightly. Do you agree? How do you feel when someone cuts you off on the highway? You've been wronged, right? I mean, that's a big deal. Like, your personal rights have been violated. We think that we should be treated fairly. It's deep within our hearts that we have that conviction. In fact, I'd even say that that's one of the most compelling reasons to believe in the existence of God. That sense of fairness, of justice as being something that ought to be true, would not be there unless we were created in the image of a God who himself is just. And yet, even though we're created in the image of this just God, when we think about justice, we usually tend to think about it from our perspective. So to us, things being fair really are more like things working out in my way, right? We want the world to work the way we want it to work. And so when we're wronged, when somebody hurts us, our tendency is to want to hurt them back. When someone does something against us, we want to do something in return. We mostly want what our Hollywood movies portray for us. We want vengeance. We want retribution. We don't really want justice. We want to get even. So how do we sort through all of these conflicting desires? How do we make sense of justice, retribution, restitution, vengeance? How do we find out what true justice is? These are the questions that David is going to wrestle with as king in our story this morning. He's going to get it wrong at first, but he's going to make some efforts to find out how to faithfully administer justice as the king. We're going to see what God thinks about all this. We're going to consider what this means to us. And ultimately, we're going to ask the question, what does following Jesus in Silicon Valley have to do with justice in the world? Well, injustice mostly lives beneath the surface of our society. Victims are usually afraid to come forward. Perpetrators naturally hide or conceal their activities. But you can sometimes see little hints, visible effects of injustice, clues that something isn't quite right. That's how our story begins in 2 Samuel 21. Here's verse 1. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. And David sought the face of the Lord. And the Lord said, there is blood guilt on Saul and on his house because he put the Gibeonites to death. The problem that can be seen is that there is a famine. Food isn't growing. Maybe there's a drought or a disease or something else entirely, but this is a big problem. David is the king, and his people have no food to eat. He has to do something to address the situation. So the text says that he seeks the face of the Lord. And this is actually a very unique phrase. This is the first time it's used in the Old Testament of somebody coming before God asking for help. He's probably surprised by the answer because it has nothing to do with farming. It has nothing to do with weather or irrigation. The problem that can be seen, the famine, is due to a problem that couldn't be seen. The problem is that there is injustice in his kingdom. Something has gone wrong that needs to be set right. In our bedroom at home, we have laminate flooring, and it's kind of those like artificial planks, so there's these lines that run in our bedroom. And my bed, like probably many of your beds, has 4 posts that hold it up off the ground. Now, this might be kind of a geeky thing, but it'll probably work for you guys. Those 4 posts, if they're not exactly in line with those lines, it bothers me. Do you get what I'm saying? Like if the one post is like an inch away from the line, but then down here that post is like 4 inches away, something's not right. Are you with me? So if I see that, I always have to like move it so that all the posts are just nice and parallel, right? Now, this is essentially what God is saying is wrong with David's kingdom. Something is off. Something is askew. There's a problem. There's injustice, and it's not quite right because of that. The issue is that a covenant had been broken. Joshua 9 tells the story of the Gibeonites. These are people that managed to trick Joshua into making a treaty with them so that they would not be destroyed. And ever since that time, the Gibeonites had been a protected people. Because trick or no trick, a covenant is a covenant. But we find out that Saul had broken that agreement. We don't know exactly how. We don't have the details of his actions. We don't have the story in 1 Samuel, so we don't know exactly what happened. What we know is that Saul has broken the ancient truce. Now, it might not seem like that big of a deal. After almost 400 years had passed since that covenant had been made. But the breaking of a covenant is serious business. Covenants are the way that God relates to his people. Covenants are the way that God provides for people to relate to each other, to manage, to have some element of trust and security with each other. When a covenant is broken, something is wrong. The world is askew. Today we live in a world of broken covenants. People take jobs with promised wages that turn out to be false. Women are trafficked, sold into situations that they can't escape. People live in poverty in our backyard under conditions that are so stacked against them that there is no amount of hard work that could release them from their situation. All of this matters to God. Broken covenants matter. So what do we do? Injustice practically defines our world. How do we respond to it? What can be done? Our tendency is to be overcome with the enormity of the situation. There is so much injustice, so much long-lasting hurt and pain and oppression. Can we really do anything at all? It's too big to tackle. You can imagine David might have felt some of this. After all, a 400-year-old covenant that has been broken, what can be done to fix that wrong? And we've seen David freeze before. We've seen him get lost in passivity, unable to do anything. But that's not the case here. In this story, David acts. He steps into this situation having some kind of confidence that he can do something about it. He starts in the place where healing begins. He starts with the victims. Listen to what he does in verse 3. And David said to the Gibeonites, "What shall I do for you? And how shall I make atonement that you may bless the heritage of the Lord?" David reaches out to the Gibeonites. He asks them what he can do for their sake to make things right. He speaks of atonement. It's a powerful word. The fixing of what has been wronged. It's the straightening up of the legs of the bed so that everything lines up. That's what David's trying to find. Notice this. Justice is not impossible. Even when a 400-year-old covenant has been broken, David does not throw up his hands and say, "Oh, well, what can be done? That's just the way of the world. You have to live with it." David thinks that he can bring justice to his situation. And so he takes action. He reaches out to the injured party. He asks the victims what they want, and this is what they tell him in verses 5 to 6. They said to the king, "The man who consumed us and planned to destroy us so that we should have no place in all the territory of Israel," that would be Saul, "let 7 of his sons be given to us so that we may hang them before the Lord at Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord." And the king said, "I will give them." You can see why I might have been a bit confused upon first reading this story. What really is going on here? What's going on is that the Gibeonites had been wronged by Saul. He broke that ancient covenant, and they desire justice. So they tell David, "If you give us 7 of his sons, that would be a complete kind of justice. If you give us 7 of his sons to execute, then all will be well." Now, it sounds strange to us, but this is actually in accordance with the laws of tribal membership in the ancient world. This follows cultural norms for justice in this time period. And David's decision is incredible. He says, okay. He says, if this will bring justice, then this is what we'll do. He seems to believe a very simple idea. And this is the idea that I would like us to become convinced of this morning. The people of God, by the power of God, can bring the justice of God. Now, we may have some questions about this particular circumstance. It seems odd to our ears. We may wonder whether their request was fair. We may question David for just turning over these sons to be hanged. We may ask if this is the kind of justice that we're supposed to bring about in our culture. Well, it helps to realize that a lot has changed since the coming of Jesus. The way that God views justice in his kingdom is different after the resurrection of Jesus. Cultures and societies have changed the way they understand norms of justice, in large part because the message of Jesus has permeated through culture for millennia. But we make a mistake if we think that because of Jesus, God no longer values justice. Some think that because Jesus said to turn the other cheek, that we ought to ignore oppression and violence. People inadvertently conclude that Jesus' message of forgiveness means that God no longer believes in seeing evildoers punished. But the New Testament is very clear on this topic. Several passages teach the responsibility of government to punish evil. The prophecies of the New Testament are clear that Jesus will return eventually to be an ultimate judge over evil. And Jesus himself, when he walked on the earth, challenged those who oppressed others, who abused their authority, and he called them to account. Some things have changed about justice, but some things have decidedly not changed. What we see in this passage is David's understanding that justice requires that evil be punished. This has not changed with the coming of Jesus. Divine mercy does not mean that earthly consequences are erased. This idea was first made clear to me the first time I heard Gary Haugen, the founder of International Justice Mission, speak. It was at the IJM banquet that they hold every fall in San Francisco. This is probably about 7 or 8 years ago. And he used the analogy of people drowning in a river. And he pointed out that a lot of Christian ministries go to the river and they help people out who are drowning. They save those who need saving. And he acknowledged that that is an absolutely critical task to do. We must rescue victims. But he said the focus of IJM was slightly different, that they would rescue victims as well, but they would think a little broadly also, that they would actually walk upstream, they would find the guy who's throwing people into the river, and they would stop that guy. They would bring him to justice so that there were fewer victims to be rescued. The idea is that victims need to be rescued, but evildoers also need to be punished. That's important for several reasons. Bringing perpetrators to justice becomes a deterrent to further injustice. When people realize that their actions might have consequences, they are more hesitant to break laws to oppress others. But it's also an acknowledgement that the justice of God demands that something be done about evil. Evil cannot be allowed to just sit there. Evil must be addressed. And as God dealt with divine evil through the cross, earthly evil must be rectified. When something has gone wrong, it must be set right. David understood this. That's why he listened to the victims and he made restitution according to their desires. He believed and he acted on the idea that the people of God, by the power of God, can bring the justice of God. But he didn't get it right. He made a mistake. Turns out, maybe some of our questions about what exactly happened were justified after all. Once again, we see a woman in David's story coming to him to help him realize his errors. This time it's Rizpah, the mother of two of the men who were hanged by the Gibeonites. Listen to her response in verse 10. Then Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of harvest until rain fell upon them from the heavens. And she did not allow the birds of the air to come upon them, that would be the bodies of her sons, by day, or the beasts of the field by night. This mother grieves publicly for a long time. She sees her sons' bodies, which have been dishonored, and she protects them. She protects them from the birds and from the beasts to further humiliation. David's act has brought justice, but it has also brought grief. And what we see is that these men have not just been punished, they have been desecrated. You may remember this quote from Galatians 3, verse 13, which is actually a quote from Deuteronomy where it is said, "Cursed is everyone who hanged on a tree." So when David allowed these men to be executed, he didn't just allow them to be punished, he allowed them to be cursed by the Gibeonites. They were desecrated and dishonored. He allowed them to go further than simply seeking justice. He allowed the Gibeonites vengeance. And I think this is one of the reasons that Christians can be skeptical of justice. It can seem like retribution and punishment and vengeance is the only kind of justice that's out there. We know that it's possible to go too far. We've seen it, and we're afraid of it. We know that something is wrong with that. So it makes us leery, worrisome about any kind of justice. But the beautiful thing about what David does here is that he continues to try to get it right. He recognizes that he's gone too far, and he tries to fix it. First, he believes that he can do something about justice in the beginning, and then he believes that he can fix his mistake and make it right. Listen to what he does in verses 11 to the beginning of 14. When David was told what Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, the concubine of Saul, had done, David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan from the men of Jabesh-Gilead who had stolen them from the public square of Beth-shan, where the Philistines had hanged them on the day the Philistines killed Saul on Gilboa. And he brought up there the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan, and they gathered the bones of those who were hanged. And they buried the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan in the land of Benjamin in Zelah, in the tomb of Kish, his father, and they did all that the king commanded. David heard about this mother weeping for her desecrated children. And so he took action. Again, to right another wrong. He collected their bodies. He collected the bones of Saul and Jonathan, which as of yet had not been properly buried. And he brought up these bones. That phrase probably refers to some kind of public ceremony. He gave all of these men, his enemies, a proper burial in the tomb of their forefather. David restored their dignity. It's an incredible act for a sitting king in the ancient world to give honor to his enemies was unheard of. No one would do such a thing. But David was trying to find that place where justice meets dignity. He was trying to figure out how you punish evildoers but still treat them as bearers of the image of God. This is biblical justice. When people commit evil, they do not lose their status as divine image bearers. Breaking a covenant is serious business, but even covenant breakers have dignity and honor. All people have dignity. We know how important this is because of how the story ends. What happens when justice is carried out with dignity? Look at the end of verse 14. And after that, God responded to the plea for the land. God didn't respond when the seven sons were hanged. That was insufficient justice. God didn't respond when Rizpah expressed her grief. She protected the bodies, but she didn't have the authority to restore honor to those men. Not until David brought up their bones and buried them in the tomb of their father, not until justice was combined with dignity, at that point, God responded. And what happens when justice is combined with dignity? God is pleased. God is pleased with justice. This has applications to so many areas of life. It's true in international relations. It's true in law enforcement. It's true for governments and communities and schools. But it's true on a personal level as well. It's true for our friendships, for our marriages, for the way we treat our children and our parents and our coworkers. It's true for our church and our schools and our communities. This is what ought to characterize the lives of those who follow Jesus. We believe in justice combined with dignity. This is what the kingdom of God is like. Everyone is treated with dignity. Victims, perpetrators, men, women, executives, and the unemployed. God has helped David to do this in his kingdom. David sought the face of the Lord, and God led him to this place. He got it wrong at first, but he corrected his mistake, and he found the sweet spot of justice. The people of God, through the power of God, can bring the justice of God. But remember that we are in the last days of David's reign. And so there's a question that might occur to us. What happens after David's gone? It's great that David has found a way to bring justice to his kingdom in this moment at least, but will it last? Will justice last? Will justice characterize the people of God, or will it just be a fleeting shadow? Well, there's a little story in the last 7 verses of this chapter that aim to address those kinds of questions. Listen to verse 15. There was war again between the Philistines and Israel, and David went down together with his servants, and they fought against the Philistines, and David grew weary. Even the best leaders get tired. Even great people grow old and have to pass their legacy on to someone else. David grew weary. Perhaps he was able to lead in justice when he was alive, but what will happen when he's gone? Well, what follows in these verses is the story of 4 giants. These are extraordinary, physically gifted soldiers along the lines of Goliath, whom David slew as his first public act of heroism and justice. Even to this day, if you go out in the street and you ask people, what do you know about David in the Bible? Most of them will say, well, David and Goliath. He slew the giants. The other half will say, David and Bathsheba. But David and Goliath is probably the most famous story of this king. The following verses summarize the slaying of 4 more giants, not by David, but by the people who followed after him. Their names are great. First, Ishbi-benob is killed by Abishai. Then Sibbekai strikes down Saph. Then Elahanan strikes down another Goliath. If you're looking for baby names, anybody, this is a good chapter. But the 4th giant is my favorite. You're going to like this one. Listen to verses 20 through 22. And there was again war at Gath, where there was a man of great stature who had 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot, 24 in number. And he also was descended from the giants. And when he taunted Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimei, David's brother, struck him down. These 4 were descended from the giants in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. Here we have the original 6-fingered man. Of course, the most famous 6-fingered man is Count Tyrone Rugen of The Princess Bride, who, of course, famously killed Inigo Montoya's father, gave rise to the great line, "Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya, you killed my father, prepare to die." I hope you recognize that reference. If not, you need to go watch The Princess Bride. Incidentally, we still have six-fingered men. I read an article about a six-fingered man in India who was applying for a job in Britain as a typist. Apparently, there's some typing advantages to having an extra digit. So, swordplay and typing, extra digits help. But this six-fingered man was a great warrior from Gath, and yet he was killed by someone who followed David. The point of this, the point of all of these stories is simple. David's not the only one that can kill giants. God's justice will continue. Great leaders like David give rise to other great leaders. And so the justice that David brought in does not have to die when David dies. God's justice will continue even when David is gone. Except that the kings after David were not that great. His son Solomon was a very wise man, but his actions led to the splintering of the kingdom, led to civil war that really was never repaired. The kings that followed Solomon were mostly selfish and abusive. And so the land waited for a king who would come in the line of David. The people yearned for a leader who would bring forth justice and righteousness, not just once, but for all time. And God promised to send such a leader. Listen to how this leader is described in Isaiah 42, 1 through 4. "Behold my servant whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry aloud or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not grow faint or be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands wait for his law." Do you see it in those verses? The combination of justice with dignity. This is the king that the earth has been waiting for. God's people in the Old Testament were promised a Messiah who would bring justice, and he came. Jesus came to deliver justice, not just once for all, but to establish the kingdom of God where justice would reign for all eternity. This king even suffered injustice on himself so that he could deliver justice to his people. If we follow Jesus, we follow the one who rules justly. That gives us a unique role of helping those in our families, in our communities, and around the world to see what biblical justice looks like when it's administered rightly. We can recognize cases of injustice in our local community. Housing policies, trafficking, salary policies, racial inequalities, law enforcement, the list goes on and on. We can help our community to implement justice with dignity. As followers of Jesus, we have a responsibility to be people of justice. If we are to be the people of God and to please our God, then we are called to seek justice. Seek justice. When my kids were very little, I would sometimes ask them to help with projects around the house. Maybe I needed a wall painted, right? Now, most of you know that toddlers are very poor painters of walls. So I would give them a paintbrush, and they'd paint a little bit, and I'd say, "Oh, that looks amazing! You painted the wall, it's great!" And I'd scoot them aside, and then I'd repaint the whole wall, right? Because that's what you do. And the point was that I was trying to include my children. I wanted them to feel like they were helping. I wanted to help them feel important. But in actual fact, they didn't really help. Now, I think that's the way a lot of us think that God works through us. That God kind of pats us on the head and says, "You know, why don't you do some good stuff in the world? I've sent you out there as a church. Why don't you go do cool things? And then when Jesus comes back, he'll just erase everything and just really do it the right way. But I want you to feel important. I want you to feel like you have a role, so go ahead and do things." If we think that way, it is an incredibly deficient view of God. It's a deficient view of God's Spirit, who lives within us. It's a deficient view of the church, of what God intends for his people on his creation. We are not children who can't help. We are the people of God. We have the Spirit of God. We won't bring perfect justice, but make no mistake, when we do work, it is God working through us. When we bring justice, it is Jesus bringing justice to his world. When we work as God calls us to, it is God at work in the world. We make meaningful contributions that then when Jesus returns, he will complete and perfect, but not wipe out and erase. The people of God, by the power of God, can bring the justice of God. Now, the Australian government is still trying to find the best way to make restitution for the effects of the stolen generation. They issued a national apology in 2008. They actually celebrate a national sorry day to commemorate this. And somebody after the first service pointed out that in America, we call that like Aboriginal apologetic administration to this. And they just say, it's a sorry day. You know, we're just going to say we're sorry. But they're trying to figure out, how do you do this? How do you make restitution for something gone wrong? And they're still struggling with it. Many claim that it's still not just, that justice has not yet been found. Which makes it all the more amazing that we've seen in our story today the fact that David manages to find justice with dignity. He seeks the face of the Lord, asking what can be done. He goes to the victims. He takes one action, and he gets it wrong. But then he addresses the issue, and God is pleased. Justice has been found. So what do we do? How do we respond then? Well, first, we change our hearts. We recognize the injustice in our world. We accept our calling to step into complicated situations. Following Jesus in Silicon Valley doesn't just mean getting by. Doesn't just mean figuring out how to live in this crazy place where it is so difficult to live. It just might mean using whatever influence, whatever authority or position you have to find justice in whatever arenas you live and work in. As our hearts change, we will find ourselves called to act. Maybe it's advocating for fair housing policies. Maybe it's getting trained to recognize victims of trafficking. Maybe it's working to balance race or gender inequalities. You can't do everything, but each of us can do something. And one very practical thing that we could do is to come back tonight and seek the face of the Lord. That's what's happening tonight with International Justice Mission. They're hosting a regional prayer night to just pray. And that's one of the things I love most about IJM. You wouldn't, I don't think, expect an organization full of lawyers to pray a lot. No offense to the lawyers in the room. But they do. They are an incredibly prayerful organization. And they believe that by seeking the face of the Lord and then by acting on his direction, that justice can be delivered. Injustice is everywhere. It's a huge issue. Our world is riddled with it. But our God is bigger, and we have his Spirit. We are the people of God. And the people of God, by the power of God, can bring the justice of God. Amen. I want to invite Brian Kress.